Today's special classes without quizzes, panel discussion, old bugs, emerging bugs, and super bugs, are humans really the dominant species on Earth? Events like classes without quizzes confirm to those of us who aren't on campus every day that McGill remains at the forefront of research on almost any subject you can think of. And that's why, in addition to drawing back alumni for homecoming each year, the university continues to attract researchers with reputations as stellar as its own. In fact, in the last decade, McGill has attracted 100 new professors a year. It's the ideas they bring and the support they receive here to develop those ideas that keep the McGill name synonymous with leading-edge innovation. Dr. Richard Levin is one such professor. In September 2006, he became the Dean of the Faculty of Medicine and Vice Principal Health Affairs at McGill, leaving behind New York University School of Medicine and 25 years of frontline medical practice at Bellevue Hospital Center in New York City. His research interests are broad, ranging from cell biology to the role new information technologies play in education. Dr. Levin's efforts have broken much ground over the years. He has been awarded 4 patents for products developed in the areas of coronary health and wound healing. A major focus for him is now the construction of the Glenn campus of the McGill University Health Center. Work has finally begun on what will be an extraordinary new health facility, scheduled to open in 2014, that will improve patient care through mobile technology, greater privacy, increased family access, and open, airy spaces that promote recovery and well-being. At the same time, Dr. Levin is spearheading studies of current approaches to education, research, and medical practice in the McGill network. Depending on the findings of the committees, one day soon we may also have a newly designed Faculty of Medicine to go with our new buildings. Please welcome an inspiring leader and innovator, Dr. Richard I. Levin.
Thank you, Anne. Thank you very much. Welcome, everyone. Bienvenue. Winston Churchill once said that he was always ready to learn, although he wasn't sure that he always liked being taught. The nature of a quack is just to sit back and learn. No risk, high yield adventure, so you'll have a very good time. The title of this quack is wonderful, but it could also have been entitled Back to the Future. Let's begin the seminar. How many here, by a show of hands, are in their 20s? 30s? A few more. 40s? Okay. 50s? 60s? 70s? Yeah. So, the average age in this audience... 80s. Thank you. 90s? All right. We'll settle at 63 and a half. When we were growing up, we average agers, we imagined it would be heart disease, cancer, maybe arthritis that would bring us down. But it doesn't look like it's going to be that way. We're going to cure those chronic illnesses in this century, probably in the early part. What we might not do is be able to handle the epidemics that are on their way. Today's panelists represent a broad spectrum of interest in this area, in microbiology, immunology, parasitology, and epidemiology. They're leaders in their respective fields, and they're going to help you decide whether it is we, puny humans, or the bugs who rule the world. It's now a great pleasure to introduce the moderator for this quack, Dr. Brian Ward, who is Associate Director, Fundamental Science of the Research Institute of the McGill University Health Center, co-director of the McGill Vaccine Evaluation Center, and director of the National Reference Center for Parasitology. A McGill alumnus, he has become a world authority in infectious diseases and immunology over the past 30 years. Having received a Rhodes Scholarship as a student, Dr. Ward went on to train at Hopkins and worked as an archaeological dig doctor in Peru, in Cree communities in northern Quebec, and as a volunteer in Thai refugee camps. And he returned to us in 1991. He's an expert on vaccines and viruses, and his laboratory is one of only two in Canada certified to test for some of the most deadly infectious diseases in the world, at least the ones we know about. His research interests include the immunology and adverse effects of vaccines, the development of novel treatments, and new diagnostic tests for parasitic diseases, and studies of genetic and behavioral factors, as well as other interventions in HIV transmission in Africa. He's sought after by high-level national and international organizations for his knowledge on vaccine use, vaccine safety, and international health. Please join me in warmly welcoming Dr. Brian Ward.
Thank you very much for the invitation to speak and the kind words. Welcome, everybody. It's not quite as bad as it sounds. These kinds of talks can really be downers. I understand that we don't have Dr. Levin for too long. I think he has to jog off to another session. So as he leaves, Dr. Ndao is just arriving, having survived the Champlain Bridge, and he's our third speaker today. So we're going to go rapidly through, three talks covering different aspects of the microbial world. And so we're going to take quite a different an overview. I'll give you a little bit of an overview of our place in the world, and then talk a little bit about the shrinking world, so looking at the world through a bit of a telescope, because the world has dramatically changed from the time that we traveled at the speed of 10 miles an hour in horse and buggy to the time that we can now travel at 700 miles an hour in our jets. Then the other part is really the expanding world as we move through the into an era where we understand more and more about the microcosm within us, the microbiome. So Dr. Ndao will talk a little bit about how the world is shrinking, and Dr. Manjus will talk a little bit about how we're expanding our horizons by looking at our interior microbiome. And then we'll have a discussion about whether we're going to make it or not. So quickly, microbes and world dominance. Basically, from the primordial slime until now, there really isn't a question. I mean, Dean Levin said, you know, well, are we the dominant species? And the answer there is absolutely not. We never have been and we never will be. Evolution has driven massive, massive variation in the bacterial world particularly. A single kilo of dirt from one of our forests contains tens of thousands of different species. Okay, and so while a few people in the world actually deny evolution, they're actually wrong. Evolution does occur. And in fact, if you look at our world, which we are just beginning to do so, as deep as we can drill down into the earth, well above temperatures boiling, we can find bacteria. Drill down into our deepest glaciers, we can find bacteria. And those bacteria can metabolize things that we've never even considered. They can live on sulfur, they can live on oil, they can live on things that would kill us quite readily. So, another level of sophistication when you consider that this is the dominant species on Earth and that it has evolved. In fact, what many people don't realize is that it has evolved with us. It has co-evolved. And so in 1999, when scientists sequenced the genome of our own mitochondria, the power cells, the little organelles in all of our cells that provide the power for us to be the complex human beings we are, we found out that, in fact, the closest relative to that was a Rickettsia organism, an archaic bacterium. So at some point in our distant past, a prokaryotic organism, a bacterium, and a eukaryotic organism agreed to live together. And in fact, they have lived together all through the evolution of the eukaryotes. and we carry their DNA in us today. So in fact, we have co-evolved over millennia with these organisms. The fact that we have done so is clearly evident in our immune systems. We have T cells, we have antibodies, we have many parts of our immune system that specifically recognize organisms. That's all they do. There are viruses embedded in our own DNA, the endogenous retroviruses. There are genes that have been stolen, human immune genes that have been stolen by viruses, and they make completely functional copies. So Epstein-Barr virus, the virus that causes mononucleosis, has a very competent copy of a human regulatory cytokine gene that signals our immune cells, in this case, to the favor of the virus. And there are genes that are missing from the genome in certain populations. So one of the receptors on red blood cells for one kind of malaria, vivax malaria, is the Duffy antigen. That antigen is largely absent from black Africans. So in fact, if we were to look at Dr. Ndaw's red blood cells, he would not have the Duffy antigen probably because his direct ancestors grew up under pressure from vivax malaria, while some of the rest of us might actually be susceptible. These are all excellent, excellent examples of how we have co-evolved with these organisms. And in fact, because of this co-evolution, we have developed symbiotic relationships, commensal relationships, parasitic relationships, and colonial type relationships with microbes, some of which will be discussed today. And clearly, when we start to mess with these organisms in terms of initiating immunity against them with vaccines in some cases, or by giving antibiotics, we play with fires. Because in some cases, the immune response that we generate is actually the immune response that the microbe wants, or at least is some compromise between what they want and what we want. Clearly, these organisms have shaped the world. So, for example, smallpox, Yersinia pestis, plague, cholera, measles, tuberculosis, malaria, shaped the world. During the 18th century, there were 1 and 2 year periods where hundreds of millions of people died from the plague. Measles, up until a few years ago, killed 1 million people per year, and certainly tuberculosis and malaria continue to be major problems. In our very recent experience, HIV, SARS, influenza, and one that you may not have heard of, Nipah virus, have all directly threatened us. And they have emerged from one or another place, HIV from Africa, SARS from South Asia, influenza similarly, and Nipah virus, which is a very closely related virus to measles, emerged in Malaysia in the early 2000s, and it killed 80% of the humans that it jumped to. Okay? It is now spreading into South Asia. Pakistan and India are having outbreaks of Nipah virus. This is a virus that could do to us, in many ways, what measles, smallpox, and plague of the past have done. And just parenthetically, the SARS epidemic, which we all lived through, gets the record for the world's worst city slogan. I don't know if you can read it there, but this was promoting Hong Kong just before SARS, and it says, "Hong Kong will take your breath away." And as you know, SARS was a respiratory virus that did just that. Okay, so as a political statement, I'll get on my high horse for just a second and say, the real superbugs are actually the bugs that have been around for millennia. Malaria still kills 1 million people a year. HIV kills 1.5 million. TB, over almost 1 million. These are the superbugs. These are the bugs we need to attack. Clearly, we have other organisms that make it into the newspapers. These are still truly the superbugs. They are the largest problem for humanity. But what everybody's calling a superbug right now are, in fact, things like multidrug-resistant tuberculosis, MRSA, C. difficile that we've all heard about, and the newest one, the NDM1, which is a resistant gram-negative organism that has come out of India, is now in Europe, and has just recently come to Canada. These are resistant organisms that are being driven by our antibiotic use. And clearly, I'm not trying to minimize these at all, but we do need to keep into perspective that there are superbugs that have been here for millennia, not just these newcomers. So, from a microbial perspective, let's just think about what we are. Okay, well, most microbes don't think we're anything, right? We're nothing. Some of them think that we're a nice place to visit. Others think that we're a nice place a nice place to get them around, so transport. Others think that we're a pretty good place to hide. And the most worrisome, of course, are the ones that view us as simply meat. Because for some microorganisms, this is what we are. Okay. How are we driving these new superbugs? And we'll just talk about the new superbugs for a second. But also some of the older ones, malaria, tuberculosis, and so on. We passed 1 billion travelers, international border travelers, in 2001. In Canada, we have switched our immigration, the immigrants who we welcome into this country as new Canadians, they have dramatically shifted from the European immigrants of old. As of about 1970, 1975, most of the immigrants welcomed to Canada came from poorer countries, Asia, Africa, South America, and Central America. And as we have started to mix more and more with us traveling elsewhere and new immigrants coming in, we basically have the opportunity for microbial mixing around the world in hours rather than centuries or days or weeks. Furthermore, we are indulging in monoculture. We are having massive fields with only one culture. We are putting tens of thousands of organisms like chickens and cows into very small places. And probably one of the worst things we're doing is this. Every time you walk into a grocery store or a pharmacy, you're confronted by this. We have aisle upon aisle. This pen is being sold by Papermate as having an antibacterial coating on it. Okay? And some of the most bizarre are the exercise trousers that are embedded. You can buy these on the web. They have chlorine impregnated into the fibers so that you can kill the organisms that come off your skin. And 7-Up actually misguidedly sold itself as the antibacterial Uncola for a while. Okay, we need to stop. We need to stop. Because we clearly use too many antibiotics, we clearly are targeting organisms that are very friendly to us, and what is very clear is that the normal flora is necessary for our health because it competes with our bad, and that will be the subject of Dr. Manji's talk. Because when you kill the good ones, the bad ones have a niche. And so we're very lucky in that we have Dr. Ndao and Dr. Manji's to give us the two talks that we're going to talk about, and to some extent it does feel like we're pushing against insurmountable odds. But in fact, I think that much of the research that we're doing now is directed at both the old superbugs while not ignoring the new superbugs and not missing out on the opportunities of harnessing those good ones to help us fight off the bad ones. So with that, I'm going to stop and invite Dr. Ndao to come up. Dr. Manji is going to come up. We have a bit of a switch because her talk is actually on the computer and his is not yet. So Dr. Manjis is I'm an older faculty. She's a younger faculty in the Department of Epidemiology and Biostatistics, also in microbiology and infectious diseases. She did her PhD work in Stanford, and we were lucky enough to recruit her here afterwards. Her area of particular interest is in studying the microbiome. So we're actually going to look at the expanding microbial universe before we look at the shrinking world. Dr. Manji?
Good evening. I'm very happy to be here. I'm happy to share a little work that I'm doing and to give you a very accelerated guided tour through the new research area of human microbiome research. So in my talk, I'm going to focus on the human microbiome. So these are the organisms that live on us, in us, and they've evolved with us essentially to try to keep us healthy in many different ways. So as Brian alluded to, we're kind of in conflict with our environmental microbes. We have the ones that are troublesome to us, that we want to eradicate from our homes, prevent infecting our children, and then we also turn around and consume about 10 to the 9th of us whenever we eat the yogurt that's typically advertised on television. So to me, I think it's a very interesting, a little bit of a schizophrenic view of the microbial world and how it works with us. So what is the microbiome? Well, it varies from different body site to body site. I don't know how well you can see it, but we have the mouth, the skin, the intestine. All of these areas of the body are represented. The colors reflect the phylogenetic groups of organisms that you can find there. So it's very, the organisms that live there are very different from site to site, and you can see that we have them everywhere. So we're a composite of different cells, bacterial cells, archaeal cells, and as you probably can imagine, our gut is the reservoir for the largest number of them. And I would actually suggest that we consider that microflora, the bugs that live within us, kind of an organ. And it's an organ that we've neglected to study for a long time, and that largely has to do with our inability to study the organisms that live there. And I'll come back to that in a minute. But all of these organisms contribute to our physiologic functions in our body. And this is just a poll. It's not a quiz, because I understand I can't quiz you. But how many bacterial cells do you think inhabit our bodies? Any idea? Order of magnitude? 1,000? More? 1,000,000? 1,000,000? Okay. Millions. Okay. Here's the answer. 100 trillion. I love that response. It's about, if you can imagine, 10 times the number of cells in our bodies, mostly uncharacterized. So if we have about 1,000 species primarily in our gut, and all of us in the room are very different with respect to the organisms that live there, there are about 3,000 on average unique genes. That's 3 million different genes, or about 100 times the number of genes that our own bodies encode. So as you can imagine, this is quite a large field. It's been going on for a long time in the sense that people have tried to understand the bugs using traditional microbiologic techniques, so culture-based techniques in the laboratory. Unfortunately, the vast majority of the organisms that inhabit our body or that inhabit the world, most of them are uncultivatable. We don't know how to grow them. We don't know what they need to grow. And so we've basically been left to study the DNA that is included in them, rather than trying to grow them. And so now, with the advent of next-generation sequencing, these massively high-throughput sequencing technologies, we can now look at very complex microbial communities and try to understand what they do primarily from the DNA sequences that they contain. So here's just a very brief introduction to the field. So we started out in 2005 with probably the first real census, complete census of the microbial organisms that live in the gut. In this case, it was three people. They did deep, deep sequencing, so they tried to characterize as many bugs as possible. So you could say that this version of human microbiome research dates to about 2005. Then they looked at metagenomic analysis. This would be genes, not just the genes that characterize the organism, but all the genes present in all of the microbes. Then we looked at the development of the human intestinal microbiota. Again, we have no idea what the pattern of acquisition of bugs, nor do we understand really what they do early in a child's life. Then we had an initiative in the National Institutes of Health, and now again in Canada by the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, to support research in human microbiome areas. And probably the best characterized or the best understood direction recently is related to obesity and how the microflora in our intestine liberate the energy that we have from our diets. And now there's a lot of very good evidence, both in humans and in animals, that suggests that our microflora contributes to, is one contributor to the obesity epidemic that we're experiencing. And then there's been specific studies looking at diseases. So things like inflammatory bowel disease have also been targeted. And this is another study that looked at the difference between obese and lean twins. So diversity, as you can imagine, there's lots of organisms there. And it's really there most likely to ensure functional stability. You know, when you hear biologists talking, you often hear about biodiversity and how beneficial it is. You can think of it in the same way internally in our own microbial ecosystems. Having all of those organisms, having some that may be very different but share a function, Therefore, if you have an exposure in your daily life that may disturb that ecosystem, there are still bugs around that can help provide those functions. And so having a more diverse intestinal microbiome is supposed to, or thought to, help contribute to sustaining the functions that we need. The bugs help harvest otherwise inaccessible nutrients to us. They help with our diet. They metabolize compounds, even things that are harmful to us. They help renew our intestinal barrier in the inside of our gut. And they also help to contribute to the maturation of our immune system when we're very young. And you've all heard probably about the hygiene hypothesis. And the microbiota is one component of that interaction early in life. And so people are now starting to look at the relationship between the human microbiome and allergy and asthma. So I thought this was an interesting picture. I hope you can see it. This is the a trace of 14 infants over the first 200 days of their life. Each line is a different color and represents a different type of organism. And you can see that generally the organisms have a very erratic colonization pattern. And our job now as scientists looking at this field is try to understand the meaning of that change over time. And I have to say that infants number 13 and 14 are actually twins. And so even when they're genetically related and they live in the same household, the acquisition of microbes during that period of time is still very different. This is kind of interesting. You can think of how similar am I to my children? How similar in my microbiome am I to my spouse? And this gives you an idea of just how much variability there is. If you look at the top line, temporal variation, so that's within one person over time, they about 75% similar over two time periods. Monozygote twins, marital partners are down around 55%. Maybe it depends on how well you like them. Unrelated persons and human and other primates. So there's a lot of diversity. That's something that's a challenge in the field. So we don't know a lot about what's the best composition of that flora. Do we change it regularly during in our regular exposures during lifetime, using antimicrobials, the diet that we have? All of those things can have a profound effect, and we don't really understand what the ideal composition is and how it changes due to our normal life experiences. And so the next step is really to understand whether people who experience those exposures, whether those contribute to changes in the flora and whether that results in disease. So there have been a few things that have been associated with microflora disturbances already. Antibiotic-associated diseases, like in hospitals, the main one I'm sure you've heard about is the Clostridium difficile-associated disease. That's an area that I study in my lab. Also inflammatory bowel disease, obesity I mentioned before, asthma and allergy, colon cancer, and then other things where there's less evidence, like rheumatoid arthritis. So this is the model that I study, Clostridium difficile-associated disease. Usually you end up in the hospital. Many patients who are there receive antibiotics as the course of their treatment. We think that the antibiotic exposure combined with exposure to Clostridium difficile, which is a pathogen, leads to colonization, so the antibiotics suppress the gut flora. And Clostridium difficile is able to colonize and infect because it doesn't have any competitors. So as soon as you suppress that flora, it's an open opportunity for Clostridium difficile to infect. Then you have an overgrowth of disease, overgrowth of organisms, and then the disease manifests. And that's what I'm trying to understand. And it's a great system because people are exposed over a short time and they develop a disease over a short time. So this is one result from my lab. Here, again, you're looking at the different colors of the pie chart reflect different microbial organism types. And here you have cases. These are people right before they develop disease and controls, other people in the hospital at the same time that are similar in most other ways to the cases. And I notice that there's a loss of fusobacterium and a big change in the proteobacteria. Those are normal components of the gut flora. And now we're trying to understand whether those changes really are related to the development of disease. And ideally, then you could hopefully, if you're using antimicrobials, you can find ways to get around the bad effects of the microbes. So if there's ways to preserve the gut flora to protect patients from acquiring C. diff and causing disease. So here's another picture from a recent study looking at the relationship between the microflora in the normal host and in a patients which have been diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease. And again, the colors reflect different microbial organism types, and you can see a massive disturbance in the cases who have been diagnosed with inflammatory bowel disease. And of course, we have to think this is important because it's been published in the New York Times quite early, actually. And this is in response to work that was done at the Washington University in St. Louis, looking at the relationship between the gut flora and obesity. And the data are just very compelling. So on the left are actually mice. So we may not be that interested in mice. But if you look, you have lean mice who are wild type, normal mice. Then in the next one, you have ones that have gene that predisposes them to obesity, but just as a heterozygote. And then the last one, you have a fully obese genotype mouse. And you can see as you move from lean to obese, you have a big shift in two of the major types of bacterial organisms in the gut. And if you look on the right-hand side, again, you have Firmicutes. That's one type of organism in Bacteroidetes. And you see as obese individuals are followed on a diet over time, this is 52 weeks on a diet, you go from having primarily Firmicutes to a larger number of Bacteroidetes. So the evidence is really growing, and there will be more studies within human populations. That's my job as an epidemiologist, is try to take some of the basic science in this area and try to translate it into human studies so we can deal with problems of large magnitude like obesity. So my last slide just refers to something that actually shouldn't be a surprise to us in the history of obesity and microflora studies. Probably starting in the 30s and 40s, the introduction of antimicrobials into food animals yielded pretty tremendous differences in or changes in growth trajectories in those animals. So if you look on the right, you have Holsteins and Jersey cows. If you see the top two lines in each case are animals that were supplemented with oreomycin, which is a tetracycline compound, and you see that in both cases the growth is quite high. And so the primary mode of action in that case, most people think, is the antimicrobials that are being provided to those animals are changing the composition of that flora and allowing the animals to actually to retain more of the nutrients and more of the energy from their diet, and therefore they grow faster. And so thinking about what we've done for decades, and I guess it shouldn't be any surprise that now we're seeing a relationship in between changes in the microflora and obesity. So I just want to thank you, and I look forward to your questions. I love this field. I'm totally enjoying it. And if you have questions, feel free to ask me at the panel session or afterwards.
So while Dr. Ndao is setting himself up, because we're going to have to switch computers because he has animation, will you just do that while I... Great. So Amy is a little more cautious than I am, and so I'll actually try to sort of put the... I'll pretend I'm a writer for a magazine and not a scientist. What this means, what this work means, is that you can, in theory, take a skinny mouse and do nothing but change the flora in its gut, and that mouse will start gaining weight. It will become obese. And in fact, you can even limit the amount of food it eats, and it will become obese. And similarly, you can take a mouse that is obese, and you can put a new gut flora into that mouse, and let it eat as much as it wants, and it will start losing weight. These are things that are just extraordinary. We never even thought this was possible. And actually, we will probably, at McGill and other sites in the very near future, be conducting stool transplants, right? We've conducted organ transplants for a long time, and we've done that very well. And when Dr. Menges alluded to the fact that the stool and these other microflora connections, collections were organs, we are already in Canada transplanting those organs from one person to another and curing diseases like C. difficile. So I think we're set up. Dr. Ndao, my close colleague, did his veterinary training in Senegal at Cheikh Atra Diop University in Dakar, went on scholarship to the Tropical Medicine Institute in Antwerp, where he completed his master's and PhD degrees. And then we were lucky enough that he decided that soccer wasn't a real sport and skiing was. And so he came to Canada. Actually, he plays indoor soccer, and he embarrasses me every time I play with my kids. They all say, can I be on Momar's team? So without any further introduction, Dr. Ndao is the laboratory director of the National Reference Lab for Parasitology. So anyone who tries to diagnose bizarre parasitic diseases, they call him. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wood. I think before I go to start my talk, I will show you something looks like a spaghetti. Can you see this? This is a tapeworm. This is called Diphyllobotryum. That can be like 15 meters long in our stomach, and that's come from people who like sushi.
Hands up, all those who like sushi.
So, and if you're, this is another one. It's like from beef. It's called Tenia saginata. So, as you see, this is another round one. It's called Ascaris. And it's believed that every year, even a month, like a billion of eggs of Ascaris are stretched outside. And the eggs of Ascaris is very tough to kill. So this is what I've learned. So parasite is a fascinating word. Why I like parasite? Because you can see something under the microscope. If you see this column just on the left, don't try to read all the parasite here, but this is, we have a lot of activity because we have something called blood-borne parasite. When you are infected, we can take the blood and see something inside. There is some called also water-borne or food-borne. There is some parasite also in this list from water or food. So just to show you this, you're going to see something moving here. What looks like this? It's amebiasis. This is something probably can get also through drinking water. And this parasite can go through the liver and cause abscess. The next one, this is like the one I show, the roundworm. This one is called a roundworm. It's a nematode. As you see here, it's moving. You can see that sometimes under the microscope. It's very easy to see. But there is also some parasite called trematodes or cestod. The cestod are called the tape worms to make it really the name very easy. I'm not going to show this animation because... And there is also called some parasite called trematodes. People are moving. People travel. And it's believed that 3% of the world population live permanently outside the country of birth, including me. I am here. I am an immigrant, and sometimes I travel. And I travel to endemic country. If you see and read, 2.5 billion of the population are living in the endemic area. And in this endemic area, they have this parasite, and this parasite kill up to 500 million of people. We are not safe. If we think that we're in Canada, we don't have any parasitic infection, we are wrong. We have our own parasite here. I'm going to show one example or two, but there is also some people traveling outside and be infected with some parasite. Good for us, because in Canada there is some expert, like Dr. Wood. If people travel or before they are traveling, sometimes it's better to see a tropical doctor and take an appointment and get some advice. This is a story I just want to touch base with you. Because, as you know, Canada is a country of immigration. You guys are great. Open mind. Canada, Immigration Canada, Immigration Quebec, decided a while ago, that was in 1999, to bring some refugees from Tanzania. What's happened? When these people came, they was inside Quebec, and it spread inside Quebec. The Tropical Disease Center at McGill University was receiving a lot of requests for malaria, and most of them was positive for malaria. That means something was going on. Doctor would contact Immigration Canada in Quebec. So we figured out, we find out, after contacting those hospitals, those were the new refugees who came in this country. We were able at least to set up a retrospective study in order to get an idea what's going on. We set up a study and was able at least to get 225 refugees screened for parasitic infection, mainly for malaria. For the second, when we get our results, what we did, rather than tracking them in Quebec province, we wait them at the airport by a needle greetings. Welcome, and we take the blood. So, I'm going to show all the results just to give you an idea here in red. As you see here, the first group were able to screen 224. 22% was positive for malaria. The second one, 26. The third one, 22. So what's happened? In some area, we have the competent vector for malaria. Malaria was endemic in Canada before, but was eradicated. If you invite me and I was positive in a barbecue, do you think if you have the right competent mosquito, what's happened? So I ask the question. Probably you have the answer. We have four deadly, not all deadly, but most deadly is Plasmodium falciparum. That was four. I don't want to say I am glad, but the fifth species of malaria was discovered in Malaysia. You might heard recently that the king of Malaysia was here to sign some memorandum of understanding, so to set up some bilateral collaboration. Another story here, talking about bloodborne parasite. As you know, to screen any compound, we're not going to call people here in this room to test if a compound is good or not. But most of the biotech companies use coral monkey, and these coral monkey are wild-caught monkey in the field. Unfortunately, these monkey came from an endemic area for Chagas disease. What is Chagas disease? Chagas disease is a blood-borne parasite. Once you get it, you can have it for 3 to 4 decades without knowing you have the parasite. The bad things for Chagas disease is the parasite can be transmitted from the mom to the child up to 3 to 4 generations. What's it mean? If my grandmom was born in South America and moved here, have children, the girl might have the disease and transmit so on and so on. And there is a lot of documented cases in North America. We are a little bit slow in Canada. We're getting better. This is a study we did because when I arrived here, Dr. Wood is in contact with some biotech company and they found this under the microscope. When they see it, they call him and we went. We check. I say to them, it's trypanosome. We were able to determine the right species, which is Trypanosoma macrisi. Due to the fact in that time there was no good test to screen the blood bank, Health Canada called a meeting in 2000, 2. And if you go back, if you go to Google and type Blue Ribbon Committee, don't ask me what's the mean. Probably ask Brian, Dr. Wood, he might know that. But anyway, because there was no approved test. Later on in 2008, when there was an approved test in North America, they called another meeting to see whether we have to screen the blood bank. Chagas is transmitted by a Ludwig bug, as you see here in the difference of the African trips. The insect excretes the parasite in the feces. For the African trypanosomiasis, is transmitted through the bite of the tsetse fly. In the acute phase, as you see here, is this child. Most of the people, when they wake up in the morning, because we cover our body, this is called Romania sign. And this is the bug, or kissing bug. Unfortunately, in the endemic area, this is the animals sometimes live with people. So that's why the cycle is there almost forever. What I forget to say also, when these insects are infected, they're infected for life. People who have Chagas, as I say in the beginning, since it's a chronic disease, they develop some mega syndrome. And that can be cardiomyopathy, cardiomegaly. As you see here, this is the cardiomegaly in a patient who died for Chagas disease. They can have also mega oesophagus, as you see here in the slides, or mega colon. In Canada, we have, unfortunately, some case of Chagas disease transmission. And most of these, don't worry for now, because these people are located in Winnipeg from this community called Mennonite. What's happened for this case is the first case, as you see here in the slides, this patient received platelet, and the implicated donor lived in the rural Paraguay and moved to Canada. Went, gave his blood, it was not screened, and the patient was infected for Chagas disease. The second one is a patient, a child who born in Paraguay and moved to Germany. After came to Canada, but certainly have the disease when he was young there, when he was a child. This child was infected, came here and gave a blood. So, but we are doing something, because the Canadian Blood Services, if you go to their website, they screen, they're starting to do the screening for Chagas disease. But before, honestly, we don't have nothing. I'm going to move quickly, because this is a time, it's really tough to talk about all this parasite, but since we have some soldiers in Afghanistan, I just want to touch base with some diseases. This one is called leishmaniasis. As you see here in this screen, there is some lesion called bumps. Can be due also to parasitic disease, or might be a patch. Linear or papule. But today, I just want to touch base on something called leishmaniasis. We have a troop in Afghanistan. Leishmaniasis is a disease that you can get by the bite of a sandfly. It is endemic in the south, even in Africa, but there is several types of leishmaniasis. I'm just going to show today the cutaneous form. But there is visceral form, but there is microcutaneous form. But let's talk quickly about the cutaneous form of leishmaniasis. As I say, is transmitted by a sandfly. Since you have the soldiers in Afghanistan, most of them, they come back with some wound, and they don't know what they have. Fortunately, in this country, we have an expert in tropical disease. They can come to the tropical J.D. McLean Tropical Disease Center at McGill University, MGH. We have a transport media, so we can help patients to diagnose this disease. If you don't want to have this disease, you might really think to have this kind of skin. So, I think it should be a shame to talk about all this parasitic infection without at least giving an example for parasite that we have here up north. But before that, I'm just going to ask a question in this room, because before I don't know, what is the difference between Nunavik and Nunavut? Oh, I was not the one. I was thinking I was the only one, because I was bigger and I don't know the difference.
What is the difference between Nunavik and Nunavut?
Nunavik is northern Quebec.
Okay, you're right. Because I didn't know before. So I was thinking I was an idiot, but I was crazy because I just come, I don't know what it is. The first time I was doing this study with Dr. Wood and Dr. McLean, who passed away, I don't have no idea. But as you see here in this slide, because we have these animals up north, what's happened is sometime when they catch a walrus, because they have a tons of meat, they share it with people around. And if this meat was infected with trichinella, so as you know, there is an outbreak. And sometime our center also get involved. As you see here in this map, all this red was the outbreak of trichinella. Unfortunately, in the acute phase, that people have fever, orbital edema, myalgia, and eosinophilia. This slide just shows outside the Nunavik, in the rest of Canada, there is a lot of outbreak of trichinella. My last slide concerns a disease called Hydatid disease or Echinococcus granulosis. As you see here, there is a silver tick form, and we're working on that. The NRCP, which is the National Reference Center of Parasitology, which is the equivalent of CDC, Center for Disease Control in Atlanta, we don't have yet the right antigen for the silver tick form. What we're using is the pastoral form, the one from sheep or goat. As you see here in this live cycle, what's involved up north is moose or caribou and the wolf. So we're working extremely hard trying to get some money to develop an antigen based on the cDNA library. Because when people get sick, humans are infected accidentally by injecting the eggs, they have a cyst in their organ. And the cyst might be located in the brain or in the liver. So people can die from this disease if it's undiagnosed. Due to the time, I'm just going to stop here. Knowing that there is also some disease we can talk about for toxoplasma, Giardia, cryptosporidium, which is a waterborne disease that people can get by drinking also water. But I think I will have the opportunity next time to talk about this disease. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Dow. I think in the interests of time, we should not do the panel discussion, but rather move straight on to questions from the audience. What may have slipped by is the fact that many of these parasitic diseases in areas of malaria transmission, active malaria transmission, the children who survive are infected for life. As long as they stay there, they're infected. 26-27% of the immigrants from the Tanzanian refugee camps were still malaria positive months after they came to Canada. Echinococcus, the last disease that Dr. Ndao mentioned, that's a parasite that lives with you forever. Chagas disease, the protozoan parasite that lives in Central and South America, goes through multiple generations. These are the kinds of parasites that live in human beings, and you might even say with human beings, for our whole lives. And so one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is the very difficult and quite sophisticated question, am I the same after I get my toxoplasma infection or my malaria infection as I was before? And increasingly, I think the answer to that question is no, you're quite different. And in many ways, it's because the parasite wants you to behave in a different way. In fact, one of the organisms that infects about 1.5 to 2 billion people in the world is called Toxoplasma. And its normal cycle is between rodents and cats. Okay? Humans get it when we mess with cats because it's the ova are shed in the feces of the cats. We also get it by eating meat the way it's supposed to be cooked, which is just slightly past raw. And in French Canada, we tend to eat our meat fairly rare. So in fact, Montreal is one of the highest places for human beings to have toxoplasma in the world. Well, it turns out that when a rodent gets toxoplasma, the parasite goes to the rodent brain, and it lives there for its whole life, for the whole life of the rodent. But while it's in the brain of the rodent, it actually changes the behavior of the rodent, because as long as it stays in the rodent, it's a dead end. It has to get back into the cat. Well, mice and rats are frightened of the smell of cat urine. They won't go near it. They stay away from it. However, a rat or a mouse that's infected with toxoplasma will specifically go to where the odor of cat urine is. Okay? So the parasite modifies the behavior of the mouse to increase the chance of its own passage on to the definitive host, the cat. So, at the current time, how many of you are infected by toxoplasma? Hands up. Well, you probably know if you've had a pregnancy or two. You might know because they would have warned you to stay away from your cats. But about 85-90% of people who live in Montreal are positive for toxoplasma. And 100% of the soil samples on Mount Royal are contaminated with toxoplasma. And Teresa Gyorkas did a lovely study. About 100% of all of the sandboxes in all of Montreal's kitty yards, right, the little playgrounds, they're all infected with toxoplasma oocysts. So how many of you, and if you're infected by toxoplasma, it goes to your brain as well, and it lives there for the rest of your life. So hands up, how many of you have been to a zoo with like one of those big open pit lion cages? Hands up. Okay, did any of you feel an urge to hurl yourself? or were you particularly attracted to the smell? Just hang around going, I don't know why, but it's really nice here. Right? It's very likely that the parasites are having effects like that in us, and that many of these parasites have those effects. So, we've heard very, very different stories. We've heard that you can think of the massive bacteria in your nose, in your ear, in your mouth, in your gut as an organ. You've heard that there are parasites living in, on, around us to which we're exposed on a daily basis. And in fact, in ways that we don't fully understand yet, we're messing with those microflora, the flora in different places. And the consequences are not always good. We're also inviting our people to travel, and then we don't screen them when they come back, and we're inviting many, many new Canadians to come in. And none of these tests, none of these refugees and immigrants are screened for, in fact, any of these diseases. They're screened for very few. So, in fact, the Canadian Blood Service is now screening for a couple of parasitic, one parasitic disease, but not some of the others. And so far, in fact, we found several people who are infected in the Canadian blood system. Unfortunately, some of those people are no longer in Winnipeg, which takes away one of my best jokes, because I've always said that if you wanted another reason not to go to Winnipeg, the only two cases of transfusion-associated Chagas disease had occurred in Winnipeg up until this year. We now know there are others. So I think we can open it to question. Are there two microphones? I think there are microphones. Please, there's a question down in the front here. Please put your hand up and get one of the microphones, this gentleman down here. Oh, would you go up to the microphone? That would be great. And if anyone else has a question, they can move to the other microphone while we're taking this one. And please address your questions to any one of us.
It's addressed to whoever wants to answer this question.
Okay. So if it's hard, I'll give it to one of the others.
I've decided I want to live another 40 years at least. I'm 62, I want to make it 102, marry a younger wife, make babies and all that, okay? So, and in order to be healthy, there's a higher risk of illness if the circumference of the stomach is 40 inches or more. There's, I think, still high risk between 37 and 40 inches, and you are blessed and to be healthier if it's below 37 inches. And apparently this has to do with all the bugs you've been talking about in the intestine and how they grow more when the stomach is bigger. So, and I'm now more or less around 40 inches or something. So what is the most effective thing to reduce the bad bugs in the intestine? What is the most effective and simplest way to reduce the circumference of the stomach below 40 inches? I already am eating vegetables, I'm doing push-ups, crunches, I often go on walks of 5-10 kilometers.
I'm going to give you the facetious answer first, and then I'll pass it on to Dr. Manjis.
Right.
Not so long ago, weight loss pills used to contain the heads of tapeworms. And they were sold to people, and in fact, if you took these pills as prescribed, you would actually get a very heavy load of tapeworms and you would lose weight. Mm-hmm. So that's one easy thing. You could go somewhere where there are lots of tapeworms and make bad food choices. But for the more sophisticated answer, I'll hand it off to Dr. Mantis.
I wish I had a simple answer with respect to the microflora. If you can imagine, I've just found out in the last few months there was an announcement that they were going to do a randomized control trial of fecal transplantation for obesity. So they were going to take stool from a lean donor and transplant it into an obese recipient and follow them to see if they lose weight in the ultimate test. Right now, we don't know exactly which organisms are contributing specifically to the increase or loss of weight. We have big categories, but we don't know specifically which organisms. I guess I would say that that's probably, you can go to the Netherlands, I think that's where the study is being conducted, if you want to take the risk. So far we don't know, and we don't know where the organisms necessarily are coming from, which food groups. Many of them you acquired as a child, and they've lived there with you your whole life. And so it may be very difficult to modify the flora, because, you know, it's established there, its own architecture, it's evolved with you. So we're still waiting for the answer, but everybody's interested because, of course, obesity, weight loss is a goal for many people.
I think once we get past the yuck factor, I think we will start to see people traveling to where this is available with skinny friends. So maybe the next question.
Okay, this is addressed also to Dr. Manji. It's related to probiotics. And I know that in some pills, they're advertised as, well, take 1 million of this, and other ones are 4 millions of that, and one has one type, one probiotic pill will have one type of bacteria, another will have four types of bacteria. What do you have to say to us about this whole surge of take probiotics?
Unfortunately, I think the evidence, I'm an epidemiologist, so my training is more in evaluating and studying the relationship between treatments and their effects. And I don't find a lot of the probiotic literature very, very compelling. It's very mixed. Some studies show that there's a benefit. Some studies show that there isn't. I think a lot of it is marketing. And, of course, most of the probiotics contain only one or, as you mentioned, four organisms. So if what I've presented to you today gives you an idea of the diversity that exists and the fact that you even if there are lots of changes, even if you take antimicrobials, you don't see the loss of all of your organisms. You still have many different kinds. So supplementing with one specific organism, lactobacillus or something like that, I can't figure out now how big of an impact that would have, given that you have 10 to the 14 other organisms that are there. So I think there's still a lot we need to learn about it.
It does sell a lot of yogurt,
it
though. question over here. And yogurt's good. Yogurt's good.
My question is, hello? Yes, my question is for Dr. Dao. I found very interesting your exposé about the parasitology, and I wonder if it was a possibility to have a print out of all your parasites.
Yes.
This is being filmed.
Yes.
And
yes.
So, in fact, it will be available if you have access to a computer.
Mm-hmm.
You'll be able to see this again and again and again and again if you want to by going onto a computer. If you would like a printout, a paper copy, then talk to Dr. Ndao after the session and leave him your contact information, and I'm sure he'll send you a copy. A question over here. Don't be shy. Come to the. Yes.
Two-part question, if I may. The first is, we are in a society now that seems to be germophobic. We do all kinds of crazy things to try to eliminate as many of the bacteria that we know of. And so can you deal with that very quickly? What are the dangers of doing that? For example, all these people who continually buy all kinds of antibacterial soaps and other materials. The second thing is, I read somewhere that for some reason or other, it appears that our mitochondria are going through a great deal of mutations for one reason or another. So what are the implications of that?
Okay. Amy, do you want to take a first stab at the first part? Or do you want me to...
No, go ahead.
So, I couldn't agree with you more. I think that just in the same way that, you know, the buzzword probiotics is selling a lot of yogurt for a lot of companies. Many, many companies have pushed their products by calling them antibacterial, and we have been encouraged to do absolutely ridiculous things like wash our socks and underwear separately from our shirts in the lay press. I think it just has to stop. There's really quite compelling evidence that a little poop in your diet as a young kid is probably a really good thing. One of my wife's, who's a faculty at McGill as well, and my favorite sort of series of events, because we've had three children, is, you know, what do parents do with the little Seuss when it falls out of the kid's mouth? Well, with the first child, you know, you take the Seuss and you sterilize it and you put it in a bag, and then you get out your other sterile, you know, from your sterile Seuss supply, and you give it to the child. You know, the second child, you rinse it under water, depending if it's the daytime, you rinse it under hot water. If it's the nighttime, you rinse it under cold water, and you get it back. And the third child, you just take it, wipe it on your pants, and shove it back in the kid's mouth. And it's no surprise, actually, that birth order is associated with risk of asthma, right, and allergies. You are much less likely to have allergies and asthma if you come from a big family,
if you come from a rural family, and if you are the third, fourth, or God help you, the 12th child. Because by the time you're the 12th child, you're a feral kid. And you, you know. But the fact is that you survive, and you don't have asthma, you don't have allergies. And so I think that we've gone way, way overboard. It's just incredible when you see, you know, the parents in the playgrounds now, you know, going around with their Purell, you know, spraying, you know, the things, the kiddie rides that their kids want to go on. That really is silly. You know, unless there's cholera sweeping through NDG or TMR, that makes no sense. Okay? So, very strong statement. The mutation rate in the mitochondria, it's probably because there's a lot of DNA there. First of all, it's a very, the last 10, 11 years, we've known that there's DNA in the mitochondria, and so people are starting to look at it. That we now know that there are many more disorders in human beings that are associated with the mitochondria because they are passed down not in the classic genetic way but from the mother to all of the children. So normally, the genetic memory that we have is 50% from dad, 50% from mom, but the genetic memory that we have in our mitochondria comes exclusively from the mother. And so it is a new and very interesting area of human biology. And yes, it does appear to be mutating at a higher rate, probably because a lot of it is less critical to us than our other DNA. But in fact, we don't really know, is the short answer. Right? I'm an academic, so I could talk for half an hour about stuff we don't really know. But the bottom line is, we don't really know. But we hope to in the next decade or so. Okay, other questions?
Okay, so this may be going into stuff we really don't know even further, but with viruses and vaccines now against viruses like the human papillomavirus, are the implications that, I guess, what are the implications as far as vaccines? Are we killing off, should we try to find a better balance, I guess, than going for vaccination? Or, I don't know. Do we know?
So, I call this one. This is, you're completely right. We absolutely do not need a vaccine for everything. And I think we're reaching a point with the new vaccination technologies where there is a rush to vaccinate everybody against everything. And I think that one of the jobs for the vaccine community over the next 10 to 20 years will be to figure out what it's safe to vaccinate against and how. So as an example, the herpes viruses, they're not pleasant. They're not fun to have. But human society has been infected with herpes viruses forever. And unlike diamonds, which are not forever, herpes viruses are. And so if the whole human population, all through its evolution, has been infected with, for example, Epstein-Barr virus from a very early age, just as an example, we did a study in Baffin, a cohort of children born in Baffin Island a couple of years ago, and we looked at 100 of them, and we looked at 100 kids born in Dorval, and we looked at their acquisition of the various herpes viruses, there are at least 8, over the first year of life. And by the time the kids in Baffin were 1 year old, they all had an average of 6 herpes viruses already. The kids in Dorval had 1 or 2, maybe. And that's why the kids in Baffin don't get mononucleosis. Because when you get Epstein-Barr virus as a tiny little baby, it's not a big deal, except that you've got it for your whole life. When you get it as an adolescent or an adult, it hurts you. And that's what we call mononucleosis. But in fact, humankind has evolved expecting Epstein-Barr virus to be there, because it always has been. What if we take an inactivated vaccine and take that away? What will happen to us? And the fact is, we don't know. Similar arguments could be made for other ubiquitous viruses and bacteria. And so we have to be careful. You know, there's no argument that we should vaccinate against measles. because measles killed millions upon millions of kids. But if there were to be a vaccine against the common cold virus, should we rush to give it to all of our children? I'm not sure. Next question. Do any of you guys want to add anything to that? No, sorry.
I don't know if this is working. Can you hear me?
Can you hear her up in the back?
Can you hear me now?
So speak up.
Okay. My question is related to vaccination, and I think we're very fortunate in North America to have had readily available to us vaccinations and vaccinations to our children to get rid of most of the big bugs that we had for a number of years. And I have a couple of questions, and that is, I've been frustrated by people, like when we went through the H1N1 vaccination last year, was that some people just want to leave it to luck, and other people are really getting out there and getting their immunization and getting it done. And so my big question is, what are the ethics of having choice? I know that we have a democratic society, that we do have choice in our world, but that person that chooses not to be vaccinated or having their child vaccinated is causing health care costs in our population that, you know, if I vaccinate, then I'm not causing that that cost to be incurred. Whereas somebody else is saying, well, you know, my kid may or may not get chickenpox, I'm not going to bother. Then they end up in ICU with meningitis or whatever factors. And the other question is that there are so many vaccinations. There's shingles vaccinations. There's Gardasil for our girls and boys now. How do we make those really good choices about what we should be immunizing against?
Okay. Big questions. And I think pushing ethics and a little bit of philosophy. We don't live in a society where we mandate behaviors. And probably the fastest way to get people to push back for a universal vaccination program would be to try to mandate it. That said, I think that on occasion there are some costs to society and to its functioning by people who, for one reason or another, decide they don't want to take the vaccine. I think that in our it's our job, it's one of our most important jobs as vaccine biologists to figure out how to communicate risk appropriately. And I personally don't believe that we should ever be mandating vaccination. But, for example, it seems reasonable to me if a family has decided they don't want to have their children vaccinated against measles or mumps, that if there is a school outbreak of measles or mumps, that those children should be excluded from school for that period. And I know that will cause a problem for those families, but in a sense, that's to protect the child. Similarly, healthcare workers who decide not to be vaccinated against influenza, and there one has both the dimension of the individual health of the healthcare worker, but also that they might transmit it to their patients. Again, it seems reasonable to me that someone who chooses not to vaccinate themselves against influenza might be asked not to come to work and to consume those days as their sick time. So, but I think we really have to become much more sophisticated in our communication of risk versus benefit for vaccines. Just think back to last year as the H1N1 virus was sweeping into Canada and we had the vaccine available, so sweeping in for the second time. And polls across the country were saying, no, I'm not going to take the vaccine. 60, 65, 70% of people said, no, I'm not going to take the vaccine. No, we're not going to give it to our children. And then what happened? There was a pivotal event that happened. Exactly. Two children died in Ontario. Two otherwise healthy children died. And overnight, literally overnight, we went from having 65-75% of the Canadian population say, no, we're not going to get it, to having lineups, and eventually, in some jurisdictions, 65-70% of the people actually got the vaccine. I think that we need to learn to explain vaccine risks and benefits much better than we currently do. I think, since you're standing there, we're probably a moment or two away from the end. If there are no other questions, then I'll invite you back up on the stage. Thank you very much for your attention and questions.
That was my subtle move. Thank you so very much. That's been a wonderful panel discussion from the three of you. I know it's been a fascinating introduction to all of us of this world of bugs, emerging bugs and superbugs. I, for one, will, I think, pay more respect to the bugs in my gut from now on. And I think also greater respect to those parasites and blood-borne diseases, et cetera, which I think most of us probably thought were over there in far-off countries and perhaps didn't quite realize that they have come here, and we need to pay greater attention to all that for the reasons you outlined about travel and immigrants, et cetera. So, and the ethical issues that have been brought up by the questions asked about immunization, et cetera, are certainly fascinating debates that we'll carry on. So on behalf of everyone at Homecoming and our Alumni Association in McGill, I thank Dr. Ward, Dr. Nadeau, and Dr. Manguis for your very illuminating talks today, and I have three gifts to give you. And say thank you very much.
Lots of red ribbons.
Thank you so much.
Looks a bit like a parasite.
Yeah, like a tapeworm. So there is a reception in the hall that you came through waiting for us out there, so please join us, and thank you for being part of our homecoming weekend.